Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is Cowan Brothers Appellants versus the American State Bank Appellee. For the appellants is Mr. Michael Schaefer, an attorney from Sioux Falls, and for the appellee is Mr. J. Chrisman Palmer and Jason Smiley, attorneys from Rapid City. I understand, Mr. Palmer, you'll be making the presentation this morning. All right. The court should note that Justice Zinner has disqualified himself, and the court has appointed the Honorable Sean O'Brien, a judge from the Third Judicial Circuit, to sit in Justice Zinner's place. First, excuse me. Thank you. Close to the line. Then, Mr. Schaefer, you may proceed, and you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Mike Schaefer. I represent Cowan Brothers, LLC, Ty Cowan, Tork Cowan, and Craig Cowan in this lender liability appeal. The procedural history of the case is this, that back in December of 1998, the bank filed a foreclosure action against the Cowans, which it ultimately resolved with the sale of real estate in 99. The bank agreed to dismiss that foreclosure action, which would have necessitated also the release of the Liz Pendens that was filed contemporaneous with it, but for some reason failed or refused to do so. Then in 2004, the fall of 2004, the bank reinstated that foreclosure action. It didn't bring a new one. It actually made a motion to supplement the 1998 foreclosure action. Following that, we filed an answer and counterclaim asserting various causes of action involving lender liability claims against the bank. In June of 2005, the Cowans paid the bank off again by selling other real estate, and the foreclosure action was dismissed. The court recast the parties with the Cowans as the plaintiffs and the bank as the defendant. Discovery proceeded until the fall of last year when the court heard arguments on a motion for summary judgment. And the trial court then, the Honorable James Anderson, looked at the various claims that were asserted, and he held that there were fact questions regarding the claims for deceit, negligent misrepresentation, tortious interference with the business relationship and with business expectancies, slander of title, intentional infliction of emotional distress, negligent infliction of emotional distress, and also held, he'd previously ruled in a separate hearing on a claim for punitive damages, that there was sufficient evidence to warrant that claim going forward. But he also held there were fact questions on the defense claims of waiver, estoppel, release. He held the statute of limitations did not bar the claim because the bank elected to go back to its 1998 filing as a basis for its foreclosure action. And then he granted the motion, the bank's motion, for breach of covenant of good faith and fair dealing, breach of fiduciary duty, and prima facie tort. The other claims had dropped out of the case. He then, based on his pronouncement from the bench, wanted to figure out a way to get this, I think, up to the court so that the whole thing could be resolved. And then he said all of the claims, all of the plaintiff's claims, even though there's fact questions, are barred by the defenses of illegality and in pari delicto. So he basically said they're all barred, even though I find fact questions on a number of these tort claims. So for purposes of this argument, I'm going to address what Judge Anderson did with those two defenses to bar the claim, and I'm also going to address the issue of breach of fiduciary duty, which is the other claim that he dismissed that we're appealing from. Now, this relationship goes back a number of years. The Cowans father, Pat Cowan, who was killed in an airplane crash in 1985, had a relationship with American State Bank and Bill Fisher, its principal shareholder and president. Their mother had died even when they were younger. So when their father died, Bill Fisher became their confidant, their advisor, their banker. And in fact, in the early 90s, he advised my clients to initiate a lawsuit against their brother for a split up of what was a de facto partnership following the death of Pat Cowan. And thereafter, from 1994 on, they banked with American State Bank, and Mr. Fisher did business with them personally, running his cattle with them. Now, he ran between, at various times, 500, 600, 700 head of cows with the Cowans. He paid them $18 a head. The 97 winter was horrendous and devastating to everybody in that area. And the Cowans were incurring expenses for feeding those cattle up to over $55 per head per month. $55 to $70 was a testimony of Ty Cowan. Cowans incurred substantial payables as a result of that devastating winter. They went to Mr. Fisher and said, "This isn't working for us. We can't continue to do this." And Mr. Fisher's response to them was, "For all I've done for you, there's no way in hell I'm going to pay anything more." And ultimately, in the end of 1997, he took his cattle elsewhere. Now, he also promised the Cowans that these payables, many of which were related to his actual caring for his cattle, the feed, the bull rentals, and other things, said that you guys can pay those bills after the first of the year in 1998. Promised them that, and they went and told these people that. The first of the year came and went, and Mr. Fisher said, "It ain't going to happen. You're not going to be able to do it. You guys are going to have to file for bankruptcy." Well, I didn't sit very well with them, because they promised these people, based on the assurances that Mr. Fisher had given them, that they would be able to do it. Mr. Fisher was the bank to them. And in fact, their loan officer, Steve Cross, said, "There is no loan committee. Whatever Bill Fisher says happens, that's it, period." So they also had incurred a significant debt, again, a significant portion of which went to breed Mr. Fisher's cows, to Pat Feeney, because they rented bulls from Mr. Feeney. They made a deal. Mr. Fisher says, "You sell your cows," told the Cowans, "if they sell their cows at Fort Pier, they can use the proceeds of that money to pay Pat Feeney." Pat Feeney says, "Do I need to file a lien or anything like that?" And the Cowan says, "No, our bank promised us that we could pay you." So he never filed a lien to protect himself. The money comes in. They take the check to the bank. And Steve Cost tells them, "Well, I guess Feeney's done. He didn't file a lien." And the Cowan says, "That's not what you told us. You told us we could pay the man." And Bill Fisher's response, "Well, Pat Feeney screwed enough people in his life, now it's his turn."
Did the bank have the legal authority under the loan agreements to mine these accounts as they saw fit?
To do what?
Mine the accounts.
Mine the accounts?
Take the money out of the Cowans' accounts as it came in.
The Cowans
were... Are you saying that was illegal, or that they violated it, or that Mr. Fisher violated an oral promise?
He violated an oral promise.
All right,
because there was an oral promise that they had made.
So under the loan agreement, the bank had the legal authority, if they chose, to remove that money from the Cowans' accounts.
The bank had the legal authority to take the money.
All right.
But that's not all that was there. There was a separate promise.
I understand that. I'm just trying to get your point, you know, narrowed down a little bit as to what your complaint is against the bank.
So it was against this backdrop that the Cowans, and there were a number of other things. I mean, the bank was telling them that they couldn't pay their electric bills, that so many electric bills will be incurred before they'll shut your power off. And they got the bank, the power companies coming off, turning their power off. They're absolutely, totally controlling everything that those people do. And the Cowans decided to attempt to protect themselves and set up the Pony Express account In the summer of 1998, a separate account that they used to pay their bills, to pay their help, to feed them their families, to feed their livestock, and all went into expenses associated with the ranching operation. It's a violation of the loan agreement, and they acknowledged it.
And isn't it also the absolute end of any fiduciary relationship if it existed in the first place?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because I think this is the, in the Garrett versus Bank West case, what this court said in that case is that you can have a fiduciary relationship where a person places trust and confidence in the lender, which results in dominion, control, or influence over the borrower's affairs. And that's what happened here. The Cowans had placed, there's no dispute that the Cowans had placed their trust and confidence in the bank. The bank admits that. And what happened as a result of that, the bank obtained dominion and control over their affairs. It's no different than a partnership situation where the partners owe a fiduciary duty because of their relationship and things go bad. That doesn't give the partner, because the trust is lost, it doesn't mean, hey, you don't owe us any duty anymore, especially if you've exercised control and dominion over the affairs of that borrower. Now, that's got to be true in every situation that comes into a court. At some point in time, there's going to be a breakdown, but that didn't negate the dominion and control that the bank exercised.
Did the loan papers by themselves then set up a fiduciary duty relationship, or was it the conduct after the loan?
It was the conduct on the part of the bank that, with their dominion and control over how the loans and the funds were administered. I mean, it got to the point where the bank ultimately said, after the foreclosure action in 98 that was resolved in 99, you need to find a third party to finance your land. So they went out and got a third party that had a mortgage to finance their land. They borrowed $625,000, and that party, a private individual by the name of Jim Butt, had a mortgage on their property. The bank never even had a mortgage on the property. But American State Bank never even had a mortgage on the real estate. Jim Butt held the mortgage. The Cowans, if they used any of that property to generate income, to run cattle, whatever, the bank took it all. They said they wouldn't even let them pay Jim Butt, the guy that held the mortgage, that loaned them the money. And in 2003, the Cowans asked the bank, because the bank says you got to have this horse sale in 2003. Well, can we pay Jim Butt after the horse sale? Yes, you can. The horse sale came and went, and the bank essentially took all the money. They didn't even pay State Publishing for the catalogs. They didn't even pay the auctioneer that ran the auction. They didn't even pay the building where the facility where the auction was held. They took all the money. They clerked all of the sales, took it, and stuck the Cowans with the bills.
I understand there were written agreements or settlement agreements during this process. Are you saying that the bank breached those agreements as well, or they breached oral understandings that were made outside of the...
Well, they breached the settlement. They breached many of the loan agreements. First of all, in May of 99, they signed a loan agreement whereby the bank agreed to release and dismiss the foreclosure action. It never did it. It simply left it in place, left the Liz Pendens in place with no justification, no reason. If you're talking about the release issues, I think there was a release that was executed in the 99 agreement and one in the December of 2003 agreement. And the Cowans were basically told, take it or leave it. This is it. And in the 99 agreement, they basically were told by Mr. Fisher, well, this is just new boilerplate that's going to become standard in all of our agreements, nothing to worry about. And they says, is there something we should know? And Mr. Fisher says, nothing to worry about. This is family.
Were the Cowans represented by counsel in the 1999 agreement?
I am not sure if they were. Claire Gary had represented them at some point during that time, during the foreclosure action. I don't know what the status was of where that agreement was executed. I don't know the detail, and there's nothing in the record to indicate that.
So what you're saying is that this is actually a question of fact that should go to a jury.
Right.
Where are the questions of fact?
Well, first of all, with respect to the defense of illegality in in pari delicto, Judge Anderson himself, I think, acknowledged the in pari delicto defense probably doesn't apply. That applies in a situation where two people act in concert, like in Quick or in the Bice case, where they're attempting to either conspire or work together to defraud somebody. That's not this case. The illegality defense, we submit it doesn't apply, or if it does, it's an issue for to be submitted to the jury. We've looked at every case. I mean, they gave us citations to federal statutes involving criminal statutes and other things. We have not found one single case where any court in this country has held that a lender liability claim is barred by the wrongful conduct, the violation of the loan agreements by the borrower. There isn't one. In the courts that have accepted illegality as a defense, those courts have said that the wrongful conduct must be both the source of the criminal responsibility and the civil claim. And the examples are the arsonist and the rapist can't sue the victim or their accomplice because the source for something that happens to them during the course of those criminal acts, because their claim arises out of the crime itself. And that's not this case. What the Cowans did in setting up the Pony Express account was in response to what we say is fraud, deceit, misrepresentation, and oppression on the part of the bank. And there are clearly fact questions on all of those issues, and Judge Anderson recognized it. Now, I looked at that. The other case that came up to the court where this issue was presented, Dakota Cheese versus Ford, and I looked at it, I reread it again, and that was a case also by Judge Anderson where he pronounced that he didn't like what the plaintiff in that case had done, and therefore the plaintiff's claim was barred. Similar to what he did here. He says, I don't accept the fact that the Cowans were upfront and honest with the bank, as he put it from the very beginning, which wasn't true, because this Pony Express account was set up in the summer of 98, way after all of some of these things happened to them, to put them in that position. Now, so I don't think that illegality bars the claim. Now, whether or not a jury is entitled to consider that, that may be an issue, you know, in the overall scheme. But our Constitution and our statutes don't say that if somebody is doing something wrongful that they can't come into court. In fact, the Restatement Second of Torts, 889, specifically says that one is not barred from recovering for an interference with his legally protected rights merely because at the time of the interference he was committing a tort or a crime. And if you think about it, I mean, what are we going to... Car accidents. Guys are speeding. Guys are drinking. Guys got marijuana in their car. We're going to get into a situation where we're going to leave it to the subjective determination of trial court. I don't like what happened here, therefore this guy doesn't have a claim.
Is this different, though, because it's based on contract?
I don't think it's different because the claims that we have are not based on contract. Our claims are all tort claims in this case. We're not seeking to recover, as those old Supreme Court decisions talk about, over a gambling debt or something that was illegal to begin with, that was a contractual, where we tried to dress it up and get a promissory note to enforce an illegal contract. That's not what we're talking about here. These are all tort claims asserted against the bank.
How close is the fiduciary claim to the other claims? Is that one was thrown out, correct?
Yes.
And you're saying that there's questions of fact as to the fiduciary.
Yes.
What effect does that have on the other claims?
It doesn't have any effect on the other claims, but it is more of an overarching claim because much of the same evidence will support more than one claim. In fact, evidence that will support interference with a business relationship would support the claim for slander of title. Some of these claims, and this was a course of conduct that continued up until actually June of 2005 when it was paid off and the bank finally released the Liz pendants, finally released the judgment that they held. And the judgment that they held, they assumed a judgment from...
Does it weaken your argument at all if they were able to pay the bank off?
I don't think it does, because what happened was they ultimately had to sell land that they never intended to sell to pay it off. They had to liquidate their land, much of their land, to pay off the obligation of the bank.
I have a question regarding your breach of fiduciary relationship. The elements I understand about the borrower reposes faith, confidence, and trust in the bank. And that's probably true, I suppose, in most cases to begin with, whenever that relationship begins. My question is, at what point in time are we talking about, or does that matter?
I don't think it matters. I think what Garrett says is it says a lender-borrower relationship can become a fiduciary relationship if the borrower reposes a faith, confidence, and trust with the bank, which results in dominion, control, or influence over the borrower's affairs. And this wasn't a normal, it didn't even start out as a normal banking relationship. These people were dependent upon the bank.
Your time has expired, Mr. Schaefer.
Thank you.
Mr. Palmer, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Chris Palmer. I'm one of the lawyers representing the American State Bank. I think Mr. Schaefer did a fine job of getting us where we are procedurally, so I'm just going to kind of jump into the two arguments that I think are the basis that we're here today, the illegality in pari delicto and a breach of fiduciary duty.
Now, you filed a notice of review on these what we'll call equitable defenses.
We did.
How does that get in front of us if it's not a final judgment?
Well, if I may, maybe it's my contorted reading of Judge Anderson's ruling, but as I understood it, he said, I'm trying to figure out how to do this so that this is not just one issue that's presented to the court. There are numerous issues, and if I rule adverse to one party on the other and it's appealed, I hate to do it, just on one issue, then we'll have to come back with 12 other issues. I may be naively, but I presume that was Judge Anderson attempting to provide a final ruling so that we could get all of those issues before you, so that if we're going to have to go back and try it, we've sorted those issues out. That's my interpretation, Your Honor.
You know, one thing that I found the briefs lacking in, and maybe you can help out here, but there never seems to be any presentation of any overall picture. I mean, I don't know if the bank was oversecured, undersecured. At some point, apparently, the Collins sell land and pay off the bank and then get a new secured creditor. But during the events, say in 98, were they oversecured, undersecured? What was the situation as to the total debt?
Well, in 98, when the foreclosure was commenced, it was because the Callens, you know, when you say oversecured or undersecured, I would probably say the bank is undersecured. It's not supported. We have no record of, obviously, Justice Sabers to provide that. But I can tell you, having been involved in it, there was a foreclosure. There were extensive negotiations. Claire Gary represented the Callens during the course of that. An answer was interposed in that foreclosure action. Mr. Gary was consulted because, as the court knows, he's an expert in dealing with financial issues and insolvency issues. Mr. Gary was involved in all the negotiations.
In both contracts?
In the 99.
He was involved with both.
He was involved in the 99 agreement. In fact, I can tell you we met in Mr. Gary's office several times to discuss these. And the only reason I say that is I was involved in that process also. So that's kind of where, if I can, I'll jump in there, start there. In 98, there's a fore-
Just one other question, Mike. You mentioned the finality of the judgment. Is there anything in the judgment itself that indicates that the court intended it to be the final judgment on those issues?
I do not believe there is, Justice Cohen. Yeah.
Thank you.
In 98, the foreclosures commenced. And
if there was no mortgage, what were you foreclosing at?
Personal property.
No.
The loan is, this is an agricultural credit. Many agricultural credits are financed, the operation is financed separately from the land, and this they were financing the operation at that time.
You can file, you're foreclosing on personal property, and yet you can file a lis pendens against real property that's owned by somebody else?
There was some mortgages the bank had. They didn't have the entire operation, all of the land financed. They had mortgages on some of the property. That's how the lis pendens was filed. In the course of that, there's extensive negotiations that go on, and in 1999, May, there's an accommodation reached that culminates in the 99 agreement. And I think it's interesting in this process to try to sort through what we're dealing with and why we're here. The plaintiffs in 98, almost a year before the accommodation is reached, have decided that they no longer can trust the bank. And they decide that they're going to go out on their own and set up the Pony Express account. They acknowledged that it was wrong. They knew it was in violation of the secured transaction that existed at that time. And in fact, Ty Cowan said there was a point in time when we went from being a partnership with this bank to being opponents with this bank. The trust was absolutely lost from our standpoint. But in the face of that, in May of 1999, the Cowans, while represented by counsel in the course of a rather complicated negotiation to accommodate a workout of the loan, represent that this is their financial condition, that they will not sell assets, I will call it out of trust, outside the scope of the secure transaction. They sign a release, releasing the bank from any acts or omissions by the bank prior to May of 1999, and go forward. The entire time they're going forward, they are breaching the agreement every day. They, if you will, were deceitful and misrepresented the condition at the time they entered into the 99 agreement. They already were in breach of the agreement.
But you use the word breach of a contract. Isn't that a breach of a contract rather than an illegal contract?
I think, Your Honor, when you have a secured transaction under the Uniform Commercial Code, I believe that those secured funds are to be, according to the security agreement, to be paid, repaid to the bank. Some of these funds were not. They were secreted into this separate Pony Express account prior to the 99 agreement.
If you simply default on a bank loan, does that convert that into an illegal agreement?
No, it does not. But I think when you have, here's what we get down to. I guess for me, it's hard to figure out exactly how this works, because the Cowans would like to come to the court and say, we were induced deceitfully into these agreements and promises were made, and as a consequence, we've been harmed and the bank should have to pay for that. Well, let's back up and take a look at it. We start with the 99 agreement. That's the first workout agreement they have. The Cowans are not being honest with the bank from the date that starts. In 1999, they have already set up separate accounts. Under the terms of this agreement, they say, we are disclosing, this is our financial condition. If you look at the agreement, it talks about what the debts are, and all kinds of things are disclosed in there. There's an extensive agreement to put together a workout, and land is going to be sold, and certain bills are going to be paid, and things start happening. Well, now, they're in breach of that. The Cowans were not honest when they went into that. So we go, and plus, I think this is really important, there's a release in that agreement that was contemplated, and it goes both ways. other than on the debt, if you read the release. So let's go forward from 99. Now the Cowans want to say the bank should be responsible for all these other things that they didn't do along the way.
What I'm just that the mention of the agreement that they have released any claims they have.
Yes.
How did the trial court deal with that? The trial court didn't make the decision based on that.
No, did not. Did not.
Do we know why? I mean, did he even address it?
He did not. The only thing we...
But it was raised?
Well, no, it was not. That was not one of the causes of action. I'm bringing it up only from the standpoint that that was contemplated in 1999 when everybody was sorting this thing out.
So that's not anything we can look at then either if it wasn't raised at the trial court level.
Other than the fact it's part of the agreement. True.
So your argument is that even though it wasn't reached by the trial court under any circumstances, is there a wall there in 1999 and that the plaintiffs cannot go back prior to that for damages for any kind of a tort or anything?
My position would be that absolutely in 99 backwards, from May of 99 backwards, they forewent any claims. There's a clear release on that issue. But let's go forward with 99, and the Cowans want to talk about the actions of the bank, and we can go back and forth about who did what and what things happened. But the point is that you have to really think about is the Cowans want to profit from their own actions. So let's think about that. They say the bank squeezed them, struggled with what bills to pay and when to pay. They created that situation. They created it. There's no way that that operation was fully being represented to their creditor as to what it could or couldn't do.
But, you know, when I read these briefs and I'm listening to the arguments, there's a whole lot of facts that seem to be argued, which kind of, you know, it seems to me when you both parties come to this court and they argue a lot of facts, that would almost indicate to me that there's some genuine issues that should be, and the trial court determined that.
Well, I think that...
And we're still arguing facts, so maybe the jury needs to sort this out.
Well, I don't know. When I get there, I don't think we are. I mean, there are facts out there, but I think the concept, if you look at what Judge Anderson did with regard, especially the impari delicto dismissal of the action, I think you have to look at the Cowans are, from a legal standpoint, they have created their own cause of action by saying we can't make a go of it and the bank's treating us poorly when their own conduct, undisputed own conduct, is illegal under any... I'm sorry, it's illegal. It's a breach of the statute in the state of South Dakota.
But is it... What connection does it have to the relationship and the cause of action? Isn't it a separate kind of issue?
Their conduct?
Mm-hmm.
No, I think their conduct in the concept of impari delicto, I think their conduct comes totally into play. Because I think they have created the situation by which they want to prosper, and I'm not doing a very good job of getting this. Let me take another run at this.
But there wasn't that much. How much money was in this separate account?
$974,000.
At one time, though?
No, run through it over time. Hundred and some thousand. It varies, and I apologize. I can't tell you the amounts. But
it seems like it was like 125 or something.
The first
like that.
Year, 68,000, and then it's 120-some. But you have to put that in the context of this to say we can't make it because of how you're treating us, bank, and what you're forcing us to do. We can't make it. You're causing us problems. How in the world, with that gross underlying misrepresentation of their financial condition, can they possibly expect to make? They created it.
How gross was it? I mean, what was their total amount that they owed in the years that they had like $69,000 in this account?
Would that have
paid it off and we'd have been fine then? I mean, is that what you're saying?
No, I'm not. This isn't relating to saying they could have paid it off, but we're talking about them saying we couldn't pay electric bills or we couldn't do this. We're talking about the cash flow. I'm not here to try and tell you that this would have paid off the loan. There were operations, these were ongoing operations, and certainly expenses being incurred on a regular basis. But what I'm trying to say is that they never let the process work. They subverted the process from the very beginning. And they say the bank treated us poorly, it didn't work, and so they should be responsible and held accountable for their actions. But we aren't. They almost doomed themselves to failure with the bank in dealing with that transaction by their own actions. And I just think it's, if you look at the impari delecto, and I'm going to bring something up very briefly, if I may. I accepted Mr. Schaefer in his reply brief had said that we had not cited any authority in dealing with impari delecto in a lender liability setting, and he was correct. And I took him up on that challenge, and we drilled down a little deeper, and I apologize to the court that we didn't find these two cases the first time. But there are two cases. One of them is F&H Investment. It's cited at 728 F. 2nd, 1050. It's a Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals case out of the state of Minnesota.
Under our rules, then, you have to furnish copies of both cases to counsel. And Shirley, how many copies to the court?
14.
Done.
Okay, thank you.
And also, I'll do the same. There's a Minnesota Court of Appeals case entitled Long versus Smead Manufacturing, cited at 383 Northwest 2nd, 452. But the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals case does deal in a lender liability context, and I will not go into that since we didn't have that before the court at this time. I would just commend it to the court for consideration. But we have here this transaction. The other thing you have to put in focus with this is this violates the whole concept. To allow this type of conduct, violates the whole context of agricultural financing. The whole agricultural financial industry is reliant upon the concept that if you pledge collateral, that when that collateral is sold, the proceeds are turned into the bank, bills and things are paid on that basis. In this setting, the Cowans have took it upon themselves to so totally subvert that process. It violates state statute with regard to the sale of mortgage property. It violates the precepts of the Uniform Commercial Code on secured transactions, and it undermines the whole concept. And I think if you look at the cases that I talked about from Minnesota, you're going to see that in the impari delecto, they talk about the fact that if you, and I'm going to not concede that there's any wrongdoing by the bank, but for sake of discussion, in the summary judgment setting where we presume the facts most favorable to the non-moving party, presume that there was some inappropriate conduct by the bank, and you've got clearly inappropriate conduct by the Cowans by their own admissions. They acknowledge that what they did was wrong, they acknowledge that it was wrong. If you look at the concept of impari delecto, it's saying we've got to compare this, and should someone be able to come in and act inappropriately, create a situation, and then be able to take action against the other? I think Judge Anderson did exactly what you're supposed to do in this setting. That is, not put the integrity of the court trying to sort out these two sets of issues. There is conduct by the plaintiffs that should bar their recovery, period, end of discussion. I think his concept and the way he said it, and we all know Judge Anderson, and he said it would make a joke of the proceeding. And I think he's correct, and I think that's the concept that you have to look at with the impari delecto concept, and that is comparing those faults.
Isn't he jumping in the shoes of the jury, though? He's becoming a fact finder, and he says, you know, the left hand did wrong, the right hand did wrong, and so I'm going to declare it a wash. And isn't that the job of the judicial system? Isn't that the job of the jury to determine exactly that question?
I don't think in this setting it is, Justice Sabres, and here's why I say that. Sure, there's acts by the plaintiff and acts by the defendant, but I think what Judge Anderson was saying, and I think what the concept of impari delecto addresses is, we don't talk about whether there's facts. There's facts there, but you're talking about the conduct. Inappropriate conduct being compared in that setting, and then compared in that setting, you make a legal ruling. I don't think it requires the jury to do that. I think that under that legal concept, being more of an equitable precept, that can be done, and I think that's what Judge Anderson tried to do.
Now, your opponent argues that it doesn't fit in this situation when you've got the wrong on one hand and the wrong on the other hand, but it only fits when there's an agreement or an acquiescence in the two to do something wrong. Like, let's say somebody's going to set up a charitable contribution corporation or a partnership, and they go out and they solicit funds, and their idea is that as all these funds keep rolling in, they're each going to embezzle 10%, and one guy embezzles 20%, so the other guy sues the other guy, you know, and that's the kind of wrongdoing that, you know, goes right to the heart of the agreement, and the court's not going to tolerate. They're not going to decide who is wrong, the 20%er or the 10%er, and they're not going to have anything to do with it. But that's different here, where the bank is doing separate wrongs, theoretically, and the Collins are doing separate wrongs.
Well, I think if you look at the case law, I understand exactly what you're saying. But I do think that, I don't think that's necessarily the case, and I can even make an argument that there's third party harmed out here. And that is, there's other shareholders to the American State Bank, there's other creditors that were dealt with in the course of the workouts of this, where the Collins financial condition was represented to be X when it was Y. But I do think that there is a basis under the impari delicto, especially if you look at the federal case out of Minnesota. They do talk, it's a pure lender liability claim, where there's allegedly a breach of that relationship. I also want to very quickly, if I may, I've only got 36 seconds left, touch on the breach of fiduciary duty.
Can I ask you a question on that?
Of course, Justice.
Before I get to the gut of that issue, are you saying that, I know you argue in your briefs about the Pony Express account and how that's an indication that there was no fiduciary duty or fiduciary relationship. Are you saying that but for that there might be an issue, or does it have to stand, or can you set that apart and look at the other relationship?
Well, I don't think that's the sole basis for the breach of fiduciary relationship. I think the Collins, by Ty's own testimony, had felt that they were no longer working with the bank. That was in 1998 that they set this thing up. I mean, they had been banking with them for a very short period of time, and you do have to show that there's a reliance, and they obviously didn't have any trust in the bank as early as June of 1998.
Thank you, Mr. Baldwin. Your time has expired. Mr. Schaefer, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'd like to clarify something for the record. Mr. Palmer stated that the release issue wasn't addressed by the court. It was. The release issue was briefed to Judge Anderson, and he ruled. He denied their motion for summary judgment. In fact, in his recitation at the transcript on page 8, he denied their motion as to waiver, estoppel, release, and then he went on to deceit in the other counts. He specifically did that because there were issues raised regarding economic duress, fraud, the fiduciary relationship, and I think there was one other argument that was raised. So he did address that issue and denied that motion and said there were fact questions concerning that issue.
The fact questions related to what? As to whether or not they were fraudulently induced to enter into that release?
All of those arguments were raised. He didn't say specifically which argument he adopted, but all of those arguments were raised at the trial court level as to the issue of the release, as a defense to the release. The impari delicto argument just simply doesn't apply. I mean, we've got we've got Quick versus Samp, and then we've got the Massey Ferguson versus Bice case. In both of those cases, the parties suing each other acted in concert, either as conspirators to phony up and backdate and forge a document in the Samp case with the client and the attorney fully knowing what was happening, and in the Bice case was setting up a sham transaction that both parties were aware of. Judge Posner said impari delicto applies, and he said the classic case of impari delicto is a highwayman who sues his partner for an accounting of the profits of a robbery that they committed together. It requires there to be a concert of action joint fraud feasors, some sort of, it doesn't apply in this case. The only defense that can apply is the illegality defense. And again, I have not found a single reported decision in this country that said a borrower who violates, who's engaged in illegality or who violates a loan agreement or does something along those lines is barred from bringing a claim against the lender for a lender liability. There isn't one. And Judge Anderson acknowledged it. And in fact, what he said in Dakota Cheese versus Ford is very similar to what he did here. He said, basically, in that case, I don't like what Dakota Cheese did in that case. I think they were complicit in not turning over the documents, and therefore I'm not going to let them come into court. And this court unanimously reversed that, saying, listen, our courts are open. He can't argue that there's some sort of an equitable reason that bars a person from bringing a legal claim. And I think, Justice Sabers, you wrote that opinion. So I think that that illegality defense simply doesn't apply, which then leaves us to all of the questions the court said there are fact questions on, and back to the breach of fiduciary duty claim, which we again submit. Yeah, the trust was lost at some point, but the dominion and control wasn't. Now, one of the justices asked about what was the status. I've looked at a lot of the paperwork in this case, and I think the bank was well oversecured during the entire time of this. In fact, that's what allowed the Collins to sell this land that the bank didn't even have a mortgage on to pay them off. That there was plenty of assets there to cover this. And why this, it just looks to me like, in this case, and the question that's always come to my mind, why did this go on like this? Well, Bill Fisher told Ty Cowan, he says, I may not be able to break you, but I'll hurt you. You know, and he was the bank to these guys. And that was his attitude toward them in dealing with them. And the bank had the control. These guys couldn't do anything without, they couldn't pay an insurance premium that the bank promised them they could pay to get health insurance, which is a result of which Ty lost his health coverage because he's got a pre-existing heart condition. They couldn't pay their light bills. They couldn't feed their horses. They couldn't do anything without the bank say-so in releasing funds to let them do that. And why they would do it, I have no idea.
Does it defeat that your claim, the fact that one of your clients admitted that they'd lost confidence in the bank at some point?
I don't think it does, Your Honor, and for the same reason that I said before. The evidence is undisputed. The bank, the witnesses from the bank admitted that our clients placed their trust and confidence in the bank at the beginning of this relationship. And it's no different than a partnership that goes bad. At some point, there may be a falling out among the partners, but once there's that fiduciary relationship, the other partner can't just go and screw the other partner and say, I guess I lost trust in you, therefore I get to do what I want. That's not the way it works. Once the fiduciary relationship is established, and that's why I get back to the language in Garrett, it says, which results in dominion or control. And Garrett also said, look at whether or not the bank was able to enter into unusual transactions or whether there were unusual things that went on. And this record is replete. The loan agreements themselves, our testimony from our expert said he's never seen a loan document that gave the bank as much control as this, a loan agreement of any kind.
But here they're represented by a counsel when they make these agreements. Don't these agreements...
They were represented in 99. They were not represented by counsel, to my understanding, outside of that 99 agreement.
Still, coming in and writing agreements and making agreements sounds like an adversarial thing when you sit across the table and you negotiate what exactly you can do. Doesn't the existence of a written contract belie the existence of a fiduciary relationship?
I don't think it does, Your Honor. I don't think I think you can have a contract and still have a fiduciary relationship. Otherwise, you'd say there could never be a fiduciary. Otherwise, the court would say you could never
have. Let me ask it a different way. There's nothing in the written agreements that would indicate there's a fiduciary relationship.
That's true.
Be outside of that.
Right. But in Garrett, there were written agreements, too. And this court didn't say you can never have a fiduciary relationship in a lending relationship. It said you have to look at those factors. And if those are met, and we submit there's clearly fact questions that should go to a jury on that issue of whether there's a fiduciary relationship sufficient, you know, that the court should have denied that motion for summary judgment.
But didn't Garrett also say that that it's a question of law?
The court in Garrett said that on the facts of that case, there was not a fiduciary relationship. And the facts of that case were essentially that the Garretts freely entered into those agreements. They entered into the cash flows. They submitted their own cash flows to the bank. And they were sophisticated, and there wasn't any evidence like we have here of the dependency on the bank that my clients had. But in addition, in this case, the bank, if my client submitted a cash flow and the bank didn't like it, they changed it. Steve Cross said that isn't going to work, and he would change the cash flows to say this. In fact, the cash flows were set up so that my clients were not even allocated money to pay the real estate taxes on the land that they had another lender that had a mortgage on. Because the bank says, well, you can let that go for a few years before it'll be taken up for a tax sale. The bank didn't even allocate in the cash flows money for things like that.
As an aside, how old were the brothers at the time of Pat Collins' death, and when did that happen?
Pat Collins died in 1985. The boys, I think, were teenagers at that time.
So they were.
I think Torque and Treg were in high school or thereabouts, and Ty may have graduated by that time. I mean, they were not, they weren't on their own, so to speak. They were still young.
So they were in their late 20s by 98?
Boy, I'd have to do the math on that. That's probably right, but early to late 20s.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schaefer. Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.